This is Radio Times. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. Just about 3 years ago, something called the Conficker worm was released, and within weeks, millions of computers have been attacked, largely unknown to their users. Soon, a group of internet security analysts sprung into action to stop the worm and track down the mastermind behind it. The threatened attack did not happen, but Conficker was a wake-up call about cyber threats. Our guest Mark Bowden writes about this incident in his new book called Worm, the First Digital World War. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic, a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, and the author of many books, including Black Hawk Down. And Mark Bowden, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty.
This is a really boring way to start an interview, but nonetheless, what is a worm?
A worm is a cunning little piece of software that actually worms its way inside of your computer, sets itself up in the kernel of your operating system, the core of your computer, and then sends out a message to its remote controller saying, I'm here and I'm ready.
Different from a virus in that it doesn't, quote unquote, infect a computer or hurt its operating system, for instance.
Well, a virus can do the same thing as a worm, but viruses have been around longer. The old viruses were primarily used for vandalism or to steal or to crash your system. And the virus requires you as the user to do something stupid, like open an attachment that you don't know where it comes from, or open an email. The worm, on the other hand, is kind of state of the art. It enters your computer without you knowing it's there, and it has no desire to hurt your computer. It wants to use it.
And wants to use it for whatever its mastermind has in mind, for instance?
Right. I mean, what the worm does is link your computer with millions of other computers. And there's two ways that you can own a supercomputer. One is to build one about the size of a room. The other is to link together a large number of small personal computers and get them all to work on the same task.
Sounds like an army of zombies or some kind of digital version of that.
Hence the word for it, which is botnet, which is a robot computer. Robot computer is a computer that's under remote control. And a botnet is a robot net, a net of robot computers.
What is Conficker? Where did that word come from?
Well, the worm was a particularly nasty one in that it was extremely difficult to dissect it. Its motives were unclear. It was propagating at an incredible rate. It was causing all kinds of problems for security researchers. So a group of programmers at Microsoft wrestling with this thing, thought that one of the first websites that it tried to contact was called trafficconverter.biz. So they were playing around with the syllables of traffic converter. And they came up with Conficker because ficker is the German word for, it's a crude word for intercourse. And the worm was a mother ficker.
Oh, is that right?
So they called it Con.
We got away with that on the radio. That was very close, Mark Bowden. So this was about 3 years ago. And one of these internet security people begins to see something, right? And they notice that something is wrong.
Right. Phil Porras out at Menlo Park in SRI International in California is part of his research is to track any new piece of malware that sort of floats out into the internet. And he has these monitors on his one of the monitors on his desk essentially logs every new piece of malware that drifts into what's called his HoneyNet, which is a chain of virtual computers that he has that basically exists to snare new malware. 9 times out of 10, or even 99 times out of 100, a new piece of malware is instantly recognizable these days, especially to someone like Phil. This particular one was totally unrecognizable. None of the antivirus companies around the world had seen this particular worm before. That really got his attention. And then secondly, it began propagating so quickly that very soon the only malware that was flooding into his HoneyNet was this worm. It was crowding out every other piece of malware on the internet.
And he could see it, literally see it propagating?
He could, in the sense, I mean, he could see the readouts on his screen. Mm-hmm. And in a given day, he might get 120 lines, each line representing a new piece of malware. Now suddenly he's seeing, three or four times that many lines, and instead of it being a different piece of malware each time, it's the same malware coming again and again and again, which means to him this is a, what does he call it? He called it a demon of a propagator. It was just faster, spreading like wildfire, and unknown.
And attacking Microsoft, right? These were Microsoft systems.
Yes, it attacked a particular vulnerability, a known vulnerability, in the Windows operating system. And that wasn't that surprising because, you know, malware purveyors are, they go after Microsoft and Windows because it's the most commonly used operating system. If you're trying to infect a lot of computers, you wouldn't go after Apple's because that's a fairly small portion of the market.
Now, he becomes part of this, I guess, self-described cabal, right? Mm-hmm. These are internet security experts that decide to try to figure out what Conficker is and who's behind it.
Right. I mean, it takes a fairly high level of sophistication to understand the danger here, you know. And in fact, as they discovered, the cabal made repeated efforts to interest officials in Washington to help stop this botnet. Even those responsible for protecting government computer networks and the internet itself failed to grasp the significance of this.
But and why do you think?
Because I think the internet is so new. I think the capabilities of malware purveyors have grown so rapidly that probably people in power are used to seeing malware as more of a nuisance or as a sort of a persistent criminal sort of threat. What these Uber geeks, I call them, these people who you know who live in this world, recognize was that a botnet of the size that Conficker was creating was not just a platform for criminal behavior, but potentially something that could bring down the internet itself.
And were they able to figure out what exactly or who was being targeted by this worm?
Well, of course, the worm targets indiscriminately. It spreads to every computer that it can invade. If it gets into your computer, the first thing it does is it tests all the other computers on your network, whether that's your office network or whether it's your ISP provider. So it's just trying to spread to every computer in the world. But what it gives the creator is a growing map of infected computers all over the world. So he gets a readout. If I'm the bot master, I get a readout of all the vulnerable computers that now have been linked to my botnet. And I can lease portions of that list. If, say, for instance, someone wanted to steal data from the FBI, well, I've got a network within the FBI that's infected by Conficker. I know I can get into those computers and I can, you know, you can cruise around in those computers as long as you want, emptying files, taking screenshots, stealing data. And this kind of stuff is going on all the time.
And I, as the user of this computer, don't know what my computer is doing or what this worm is doing in my computer.
Right.
I'm in the dark.
You would be totally in the dark unless you download a piece of software which you can get from the Conficker Working Group's website for free, which will diagnose whether you're infected or not. And mm-hmm. It's a very easy thing to get rid of. But unless you do that, you would never know that it's in your computer, and it's unlikely you would ever realize it's turning your computer on and using it.
Now, these experts, this cabal of experts, were they ever able to track down who the creator or mastermind of this Conficker worm?
Not yet.
Not yet. And we should say it's still out there.
It's still out there. And you know, it's interesting. A lot of people looking at the threat posed by the Conficker worm sort of heaved a sigh of relief in spring of 2009, which was really the first time, April 1st, was the first day that the botnet had the potential to take down the internet if it wanted to. And when it did not, when it in effect did not do the worst possible thing that it could do, a lot of people just kind of forgot about it and said, you know, well, Conficker is not really a threat. The truth is it's still every bit as much a threat today as it was in the spring of 2009. It is, you know, whether you consider it significant that somebody has control of a digital weapon that could take down all telecommunications in North America and bring down the internet, whether you think that's something to worth knowing or not is, you know, up to you. I think it's a pretty significant thing.
Which of course raises a whole host of questions, which is that if this person, we'll say, you know, has the capacity to bring down the internet, Why haven't they?
Well, the best guess is that they built it to make money. That's one and the most likely theory. And the way that you make money with a botnet is you lease out portions of infected computers that are part of your network. Just earlier this year, in 2011, a criminal gang in Europe was arrested, and they had leased a portion of the Conficker botnet and used those infected computers to drain the bank accounts of some hundreds of thousands of Americans to the tune of $72 million overnight. And they had even hired people in the United States to show up at banks with all the necessary codes and information to drain these bank accounts and transfer the money to the botmasters' headquarters in Europe. Unwittingly. I mean, they were mules for criminal operation, but they had been lured to do this online as a way of making money, you know, and there was a whole long, you know, sort of legitimate excuse for doing it. So whoever is behind the botnet apparently so far has used it only as a tool for criminal enterprise. Another theory why they haven't used it is if you were a nation state and you wanted to build a powerful weapon that you could use in the event that you went to war against the United States or whatever country, I mean, just about every country in the world is part of the Conficker botnet, you could then use the Conficker botnet as a weapon to essentially cripple telecommunications in whatever country you are about to attack or with whom you're at war.
And is this cabal, and has the federal government then continued to try to figure out who's behind this and also institute some kind of security measures to protect against a takedown of the internet?
Very much so. You know, I think this episode with the Conficker worm, which was taking place, you know, during a presidential election year, really awakened the federal government to the threat and also how ill-prepared they were to deal with it. In fact, President Obama, about a month after being sworn in, gave a speech about the need to significantly increase our cybersecurity in this country and cited the Conficker worm specifically as the reason, as an example of how vulnerable we were. And in fact, some of the folks that I've written about in Worm who were part of the cabal have now been hired by government agencies. So the federal government has instituted a number of changes that are significant. And so they're big players, and they're still very much looking for the person behind this worm.
And that's Mark Bowden, our guest today on Radio Times. We're talking about the Conficker worm, and that's the subject of his new book called Worm, with the very scary subtitle, The First Digital World War. He told us before he sat down that there's actually some humor in this book, and perhaps after this very short break, we'll try to find out what's so funny about all of this. He, of course, is the author of many books, including Black Hawk Down. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic and a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. Taking a very short break, then we'll get back to our conversation. Also, opening up the lines at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Drexel University Online supports WHYY and offers over 100 online degrees for those thinking about sharpening work skills or advancing their career. With a focus on practical learning and faculty committed to excellence in education, Drexel offers online master's degrees in electrical and software engineering, engineering management, and computer science. To learn more about earning a master's, bachelor's, or a certificate, it's drexel.com. To request more information, drexel.com.
We want it to be loose because anything could happen. We don't rehearse, you know. We have to believe in what the other guy's going to do and make it work.
On Canvas, in the Pocket Band.
Tomorrow night at 10 on WHYY-TV.
The Greater Wildwood Chamber of Commerce supports WHYY and presents the Greater Wildwood Fabulous 50s Weekend, October 14th and 15th. Highlights include a Friday night dance party featuring Jerry Blavitt and a live concert featuring five 50s acts, with the headliner being Little Anthony and the Imperials. Also on Saturday is a street fair, open to the public with live music and vendors. For tickets and information, gwcoc.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Mark Bowden. He's been a guest on Radio Times over the last 20-plus years and has written a fair amount about war and conflict. His books include Black Hawk Down, Killing Pablo, Guests of the Ayatollah. His new book is about a new kind of potential warfare, one that involves computers and things like botnets. It's called Worm, the First Digital World War. And we're talking about a worm called the Conficker worm and the threat that it posed about 3 years ago, and also about a group of internet security experts who teamed up to stop the Conficker worm. And lines open at 1-888-477-9499. So now that you've scared us, so what's so funny about your book?
Well, I find it humorous. A number of things about it humorous. One is just how dizzyingly complex these concepts are. You can't begin to talk to one of these uber geeks, as I call them, about their work I couldn't get through a conversation with them without stopping them literally every sentence and saying, you know, what's this? What does this mean? What does that mean? So, and I saw that, you know, they live in a world like that where, you know, they're extraordinarily driven and focused and highly knowledgeable, the best in their fields. And yet no one knows what they do, and they can't explain what they do to anyone else. And to me, there's an element of humor there. I think there's a kind of black humor, too, in the notion that, you know, our modern society rests increasingly on this undergirding, this digital undergirding of the internet. And we lean on it heavier and heavier and heavier every year. I think it's true in all of our lives. It's also true as a society we do. And yet the infrastructure itself is as fragile as can be. It was a product of this sort of hippie era, born of a kind of utopian notion of how the free exchange of information would revolutionize the world and
democratize, you know, everything.
Sure.
Right?
Tyrants would tremble, and, you know, if power to the people. And in a way, the internet is the embodiment of all that. But the part that, you know, I think somewhat humorously we forget is that part of human nature is predatory, evil, you know, out to do harm. And just as any tool in history that has been, you know, created for the most benign purposes has been turned to use as a weapon or to do harm. And, you know, the internet is exactly the same way. So, you know, if you find, I'm maybe strange that I find some humor. I found some humor in the total ineptitude of the federal government. The fact that the people charged, you know, with these, who have these big titles in Washington, who are responsible for protecting computer networks, were literally in over their heads. They had no idea.
They didn't understand the threat. They didn't understand how all this worked.
They did not know what was going on. They didn't understand the significance of what was going on. They didn't really understand what the guys in the cabal were doing. It's both tragic and funny how ill-prepared they were to deal with this. But, you know, it's very real, and it's very much a part of our modern world.
And the guys in the cabal, was the cabal, or perhaps even is the cabal, is it all a male, a boys' club? Is it all men?
All men. You know, these are, you know, I think there's sort of cultural avenues going back 20 years of kids who would sit in their basements and hack into computer systems. And all of these guys who are now middle-aged, most of them, and very successful at what they do, began with this kind of fluency with computers back when computers were in their infancy. And they've grown up with computers and with the internet. And they are. I mean, they're all male. I'm sure there are women programmers out there, but not in this particular group.
And how close have they gotten, or do you know that they have gotten, to figuring out the identity of the person or people behind the Conficker worm? What are some of the theories?
Well, if the first theory came from the fact that one of the little tricks that the worm does when it enters your computer is checks to see if you have a Ukrainian keyboard. And if you do have a Ukrainian keyboard, it will self-destruct. It won't infect your computer. Well, this would protect if the creator is in the Ukraine, and if the law in the Ukraine really only covers crimes against Ukrainian citizens, you know, you could operate presumably with impunity if you had built this factor into the program. So that was a clue. Also, some of they've been able with great effort to track what's ground zero, the original launching point for the worm, and it was launched from a place in Buenos Aires in a community that's heavily Ukrainian. That and a number of other indicators, I could go on, but they're fairly sure it's there, and they may know more now than I know. The FBI would not talk to me about this. They broke this ring in Europe, for instance, that was utilizing the Conficker botnet, and I know one of their hopes was that some of the people they arrested there might lead them to the Conficker genius behind it.
Interesting. I'm looking at the subtitle, The First Digital World War. I mean, you know, God forbid, but if this had been successful, what would that war look like?
Well, it was successful. It is successful. It has created the world's largest botnet. It exists all over the world. You know, it was a war in the sense that the cabal had to go to every top-level domain for every country in the world to get permission to try and block the worm's access to computers on their networks. So it was a truly global effort, an unprecedented one, to try and corral the Conficker worm. And in the end, they did not succeed. The only thing that's happened at the end is that whoever put this great tool together so far has chosen not to use it as a weapon.
Which raises a whole host of questions about, you know, what future conflicts would look like. What does victory look like? What does success look like? What does, you know, failure, loss look like?
Well, one thing I can guarantee you is that if we ever go to war against another country with any level of industrial sophistication, the first attacks will be computer attacks. Mm-hmm. And they will do their level best to disrupt the electrical grid in this country. Just think. If all telecommunications in America went blank for even just for a few hours, but you're talking days. And if you don't know who's behind the Conficker botnet or where these attacks are coming from, suppose they overwhelm the root servers for the internet, crash the internet. Well, you could maybe get it back up and running in a few hours or a few days. What's to stop them from just crashing it again? Until you find who is pulling the levers on this thing, you really can't stop it.
How did you get close to this cabal, you know, these uber geeks, as you call them? I mean, did you have to jump through hoops to sit next to them and watch them do what they do?
It was hard, and it wasn't hard because they were making it difficult for me. It was hard because I think it's so rare that they find someone as determined as I was to understand what was going on, and they're so used to seeing what I call the glaze, you know, the look of non-comprehension that comes over someone's face, and conversations end there. That's just kind of their way of life. So their initial reaction was always, well, you know, I don't really have time to talk to you. You know, it would be hard to explain. And I would say, well, I have the time, and you know, I really want to know. And once I John Crane was the first person who really sat down and held my hand and tried to make me understand. He turned out to play a key role in this, and he works for ICANN. He's this British guy who lives out in Long Beach. And once John was convinced that I was serious about what I was trying to do, you know, he led me to others. Rodney Jaffe, who is the head of the Conficker Working Group, was extremely helpful to me, and I think was impressed by my willingness to try to grasp some of these more difficult concepts.
They were an eclectic, yes, they were all uber geeks, but also a very eclectic mix of them.
They were.
Young and old and various kinds of experiences.
Right, and defying the stereotypes in many cases. I mean, Rodney Jaffe, who I just mentioned, is a South African, and he started working for Radio Shack. He was living in South Africa, and they kept drafting him into the army. This is during the apartheid years. And he decided he couldn't, in good conscience, fight for the white majorities or minority. So he left, and he took this job with Tandy, the Radio Shack people, and he just fell in love with computers. And he started a couple companies on his own. He moved his family to Los Angeles. He worked as a volunteer for the Los Angeles Police Department. He actually drove their mobile command headquarters during the Rodney King riots in Los Angeles. But he also created the first sort of computer tracking of crime for the Los Angeles Police Department, all as a volunteer. And so then he went on to create a couple companies, made a lot of money. He has a big collection of vintage sports cars. And on the side, he is head of security for this company called Newstar, which is kind of a trunk operator for all the telecommunications in North America and a lot of the internet. And because something like Conficker threatens his, Neustar's infrastructure, he has to be, you know, very interested and very engaged. And also Rodney happens to be a very forceful, articulate guy, charming, and, you know, he is evangelical about trying to make people understand what the threats are.
I hear, feel movie here, Mark Bowden.
Well, you know, people have talked to me about this, and I have friends in Hollywood, and I've had experiences there, and I tell them I have no idea how anybody can turn this into a movie.
Mark Bowden is our guest today on Radio Times. And speaking of movies, author of the best-selling Black Hawk Down, which was made into a movie, has also written some other books, including Killing Pablo, about the Colombian cocaine king Pablo Escobar. Also wrote a book about the Iran hostage crisis, guest of the Ayatollah. And his new book is about a new kind of warfare, and it's called Worm, the First Digital World War. Joining us today on Radio Times, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I want to segue from your book to the fact that you have written a lot about conflict and targeted assassinations, and get your opinion on the drone strikes that were used to essentially kill Anwar al-Awlaki. This is the Yemen-American cleric living. He was living in Yemen, had been living in the United States. He was targeted and killed by the United States. Some people are troubled by this. Others feel like this was a guy that had allied himself with al-Qaeda, had essentially declared war on the United States. What are you thinking about when you read about this story?
Well, I think about all those things. I personally am pleased that he's no longer with us. I think he was a real danger to this country. And when I think of folks like him planning attacks, I think of my children and my grandchildren being victims of people like this. So he made no bones about his intentions. He acted on his intentions. So, score one for the USA in taking him out. But at the same time, the method of targeting folks and now American citizens without any kind of due process is one that I think we ought to be very concerned about and careful about in this country. It gives the federal government an extraordinary amount of power over life and death without any public due process. And I think we need to, as a country, particularly because I think this is the way we're going to be fighting this war for the foreseeable future, we need to answer some really serious civil liberties and procedural questions to make sure that we aren't just handing over this kind of life and death power to a few, you know, executives in the White House.
I was trying to compare and contrast, and it's very difficult to take terrorism and try to apply it to World War II. But imagining an American citizen who decided to, you know, be one of the leaders of the Nazis and the German military, and how we would feel if we had targeted that person. It's an imperfect comparison. But I think as people wrestle with this, the question is, what happens to an American citizen who is afforded some of these constitutional protections who goes over to the other side?
I think that the answer is ought to be some kind of formal procedure for revoking a person's citizenship. I mean, we all as American citizens have certain rights and privileges, and they're recognized by our government. But I think you can, it seems to me, act in such a way by targeting your fellow citizens, by preaching against the United States, by attacking the United States, forfeit your rights as an American citizen. But I don't think that decision should be made by, you know, a group of a National Security Council people in the White House. I think there ought to be some formal procedure where you invite this person to come defend himself, but he has to show up in person to do so. And believe me, it would provide, I think, a legitimate procedural process before simply shooting a missile at somebody.
So it's not enough for someone to renounce their American citizenship or even to declare war on the United States. You're saying the United States should go through the process of revoking that citizenship, thereby making that person a non-American.
Yeah, I've not made a study of what the legal issues are here. I don't even know if it's, you know, you can revoke someone's citizenship. Mm-hmm. I presume we can. I suspect it's probably been done. But whatever the procedure is for doing that, it seems to me to be the appropriate forum for sorting out whether an individual deserves the protections of American citizenship, mm-hmm. given, you know, their actions and out in the world at large.
I'm thinking about, and I actually interviewed you about killing Pablo, the Colombian cocaine king, Pablo Escobar, and I'm embarrassed to say I forget all the details mm-hmm. of the story, but do you think there are some lessons from the so-called, you know, war on drugs or how we deal with the illegal drug trade that could be applied to terrorism?
Oh, certainly. I think that the hunt for Pablo Escobar is the template for how the United States is and will be fighting this war against terror on a number of fronts. I do think that terror organizations are fairly small. They're very much influenced and directed by individuals who are charismatic and impassioned and smart. And I think it's proven to be an extraordinarily effective way of dealing with these non-state threats is to go after the people who are at the top and get rid of them. I think the other way that it's a template is that we were able to track down and kill Pablo Escobar by working very intimately with the Colombian police. And I think that was more, if you read the book Killing Pablo, yeah. It was an American-assisted effort, but it was primarily a Colombian effort. And I think that is the way you go after terrorists who are hiding in a population in Pakistan or in southern Philippines or in Yemen. I mean, we need to, I think the United States needs to have as small a footprint as possible and bring whatever kinds of aid we can to local authorities who have their own reasons for being at war with this individual. That was certainly the case in Colombia. Anytime the United States is seen to be using and projecting force anywhere in the world sort of arbitrarily, it has as much or greater a backlash than whatever good comes from what we've done. So far better that if al-Awlaki, in my opinion, would have been better if he had been killed by an attack by a group of Yemeni special forces than, you know, an American missile.
We're almost up on a break here, but my reading of it, and I'm just quoting from what I read, which was that there was some assistance from Yemeni officials about the whereabouts of al-Awlaki. Beyond that, I don't know, but yeah. Obviously there was at least some sub rosa.
Well, that's how you find them. I mean, certainly a bunch of American CIA people, no matter how good they are not going to know the lay of the land as well as people who've lived their whole lives, who know the culture, who speak the language. But I think to the extent that we lean on those folks, we provide them assistance, the better it is for us. It's a better tactic.
Let's take that short break. We'll get back to our conversation with Mark Bowden. He's a national correspondent for The Atlantic. He's also a contributing editor for Vanity Fair. He's the author of a number of books, including a new one called Worm, The First Digital World War. And after this very short break, I want to talk about a USO tour that he is taking in about a month or so. And we'll be taking some calls at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Devon Prep, a private Catholic college preparatory school for young men in grades 6 through 12. Through challenging academics, a devotion to Christian values, competitive athletics, and a commitment to service, Devon Prep students can receive the foundation necessary to face the challenges of life with confidence. On Sunday, October 9th, from 1 to 4 p.m., Devon Prep will host an open house on their campus in Devon, Chester County. More at devonprep.com.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. The construction industry made up 5% of American jobs, but 20% of all jobs lost in the recession. We'll see how that industry is faring. Also, teaching foreign doctors about Midwest culture in order to better treat patients. That's Public Radio's Daily Digest of News and Culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Another bride.
Bristol Riverside Theater supports WHYY and presents Barrymore October 11th through the 30th.
an intimate portrayal of the wives and the women, the notoriety and the glory, the sorrow and humor of one of Hollywood's favorite rogues. BRT's Keith Baker brings to life the enigmatic Philadelphia actor. For tickets to Barrymore, 215-785-0100 or brtstage.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscowane talking with Mark Bowden about a number of things, including a conficker or the conficker worm that came to life in a sense about 3 years ago. And it's a subject of his new book called Worm, The First Digital World War. We were also talking about the targeting of Anwar al-Awlaki, who was killed, the Yemen-American cleric targeted and killed by a drone strike this week. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. I do want to talk about your USO tour, but let me first get, looks like Berkeley from Hokesson to join our conversation. Berkeley, hi, go ahead, you're in the
Mark.
Air.
Hi, Berkeley.
Go ahead, Berkeley.
How are you doing? This is it. I wanted to ask you a question. You're such a nice guy and write about so many bad people.
Thanks.
But, what do you think of the difference of the more clinical way of killing terrorists with drones versus the more messy way? I find America always gets very wincy about targeted hit teams going in, but we don't mind drones at all.
Well, that's interesting, Berkeley. Let me give Mark Bowden the chance to respond.
Well, I think that's always been the case, and it makes perfect sense. Armies and soldiers have been trying to find ways of killing their enemies without exposing themselves to danger for as long as people have been at war. So it's perfectly understandable why Americans would be less squeamish about targeting people from 20,000 feet than sending a bunch of SEALs down, you know, who conceivably could get hurt doing this kind of thing. And also, you know, killing up close is an uglier business. But I think it's purely a matter of tactics. If you've made the decision that you're targeting someone and you're going to kill them or arrest them, I mean, those are determinations that are made, and you use the tactics that are best suited to the to the mission.
It does feel more, you know, quote unquote, clinical.
It does.
And maybe that's a good thing.
I know. I would love to write a story. In fact, I'm pursuing a story about the folks who fly these drones out in, you know, Missouri or Arizona or wherever it is they're sitting in a trailer. And, I think it's definitely a new element of how we fight.
And perhaps we need to figure out, the impact of something like that on an individual, as you say, in a trailer somewhere in the Midwest.
Yeah,
people thousands of miles around the world.
I guess we'll find out. You know, maybe I'm cynical enough to think that it would take a special person to be really heavily bothered by it, in the way, someone who's actually had to slit someone's throat might be living with that nightmare for the rest of his life. Pushing a button and watching something explode on a screen, unless you go to the trouble of really trying to figure out, you know, exactly what happened. There are a few steps involved there that I think are readily avoided by most people.
There are, of course, those civilians who have gotten killed in some of these drone strikes.
Yes, it's true. And it's, that's also true of any kind of military assault. Mm-hmm. I think that, you know, the use of force is always ought to be a last resort. Ought to be done for only an extraordinarily good reason, and ought to be done with the full knowledge that people are going to get killed who don't deserve to get killed, which is, you know, yet another reason to be very, very careful about when and where you use it.
Berkeley, thanks for the call to Radio Times. You can call as well, 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. You're leaving in about a month or so. It's a USO tour. Have you ever done that?
No, I never have. I have been to war zones and military bases around the world, but I've always gone with a pad and pen in hand. This time, I don't know if they're going to make me sing and dance or what. I hope not. But I was invited. I was flattered to be asked. It sounds like an adventure. And I'm going with a group of other writers, Clive Cussler and Sandra Brown and Andrew Peterson. So I'm sure we'll have fun.
Where are you going?
We've been told we're going to Afghanistan, and I think what happens is you probably be at Bagram or one of the big bases there, and then every day board helicopters and go out to various encampments or outposts around the country where, you know, you give soldiers who are away from home and in fairly isolated conditions an opportunity to talk to people from the States and feel like, you know, what they're doing is important and that we care. And I have, because of my books, Black Hawk Down and Killing Pablo in particular, a fairly large readership in the military. And so the idea is, I guess, some of these folks would be happy to see me.
And the idea, I mean, that's very different from interviewing someone in the field somewhere, which is, to, I mean, it sounds almost more therapeutic. I mean, it gives soldiers a chance to talk to a writer who's written about soldiering.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's an opportunity to try to give something back. You know, when I'm traveling, I'm going to gather information for stories that I'm writing, and I get helped all the time by soldiers and, in this case, you know, computer security people. But my job is really going up to people saying, will you please help me, tell me things? And people do all the time. And so in those rare instances when someone says, would you do this for us, you know, I feel pretty much obliged to do it.
And is this part of the Missouri Warrior Writer Project?
No, that's a separate thing. I was asked by the Missouri Warriors Writers Project, which is a Missouri Humanity Council's project to encourage veterans to write about their experiences. And they asked if I would serve as a judge for the nonfiction work. And again, you know, I asked them how long the pieces were going to be and how many of them there were going to be. And it seemed manageable, so I said I would do it.
And what's manageable?
Well, they said that each piece would be like 5,000 words long and that they would be screened so that I would only get the pieces that they felt were in the running for a prize. So I felt like I could do that.
Have you ever done that before?
Yeah,
have
I was
been
a judge? I was a judge for the National Book Awards a few years ago.
Oh.
Talk about a ridiculous assignment. They sent us, all of us judges, 500 or more books, supposedly to assess and weigh for the National Book Award. I mean, you just made a gesture, Marty, how could anyone possibly do it?
Right.
It's impossible. And I told them that, and I don't know that they've changed the procedure, but I mean, it's not a fair way of doing it. I did my best, as did all the other judges on the group, but I think any of us would say it's not a fair way of evaluating people's work.
And talk about way, right? I mean, 500 books. That
well, I'll tell
lot.
You what, the local libraries love me because I was arriving with big boxes and boxes of new books.
But I wonder, it's one thing to judge, you know, for the National Book Award, but it's another, it seems to me, to judge what a soldier or a Marine, you know, writes about their experience of war, whatever that experience is.
Not to me.
No?
No. I mean, I'm judging it as a piece of writing and as a piece of storytelling. And, you know, I think if my job is to try to pick out what really rises to the top, what really, you know, grabs me and engages me, I'm in a pretty good position to do that. I've been writing, composing stories my whole life, and you know, they want my judgment. I'm more than happy to give it.
And are there war correspondents or even writers of fiction of war that you gravitate to, that you feel have really captured what it is to be in war?
Sure. I mean, there are many of them. I think most recently, Carl Marlantes' book Matterhorn last year, which was a book he spent 35 years writing about Vietnam, was just one of the most powerful books I've ever read about warfare and about men at war. But I, you know, I loved Norman Mailer's book, The Naked and the Dead, Ernest Hemingway's Farewell to Arms, you know, Tim O'Brien.
Yeah.
You know, I'm not someone who devours military writing in particular, but a good novel is a good novel. I love Dennis Johnson's book, Tree of Smoke, which I think won the National Book Award a few years ago, and I just think it's a brilliant piece of fiction, and it's about a CIA agent in Vietnam, and I recommend it to anyone. But, you know, I also really like Graham Greene's books, and good writing is good writing.
I'm curious about the way you work when you're in the field, and I also am curious about, have you ever been to Afghanistan before?
I have never. I've been
You've
to
never.
Pakistan and lots of in Yemen and you know, lots of places in the Middle East, but I've never been to Afghanistan.
And I'm just curious about, I mean, do you think about how you want to approach these soldiers, or what do you want to talk about, or I mean, do you have a game plan for something like this, or you do what you do when you're on assignment?
I'm just going to try and stay healthy, and we're going to be up, we're told, at all hours. You know, flying evasive patterns in helicopters and things like that.
You're smiling as you say that.
I just think it's going to be an adventure. What you do is you give yourself over to it. I'm not planning to write anything about this experience. It's so in some ways, it's kind of a mental vacation for me. Mm-hmm. And I intend to just try to be useful. I'll, you know, do what folks want me to do. If they want me to give a talk, I'll give a talk. If they want me to answer questions about writing or sign my books or, you know, talk to them about working with Jerry Bruckheimer, you know.
Which they probably want to know about.
Whatever
that,
they want. The one thing I draw the line at is singing and dancing.
But it is a USO tour. You know, you never know. You never know. I was reading an interview with you. I think it was on Talk of the Nation, talking about this Missouri Warriors Writers Project. And that one of the comments you made was that stories about war are more than just PTSD. I think we focus, and I include myself in this, we interview people about war expecting all these stories about, and they're real, and they certainly are part of war, about being traumatized and the after effects of war. But you said, you know, in many ways, we have to think about another side of war that isn't all about trauma and loss.
Of course not. No, there's actually a Pew study that just came out today that said that over 90% of soldiers who serve in war zones are proud of their service, who feel that they grew as a result of it. They have very positive feelings about what they were doing. It has, you know, been beneficial to them in their lives. So, you know, when I'm asked, am I going to be reading all stories about, you know, emotional trauma and difficulty, in my experience, no. I mean, there are funny stories that people write about experiences that aren't necessarily about combat. I mean, when I worked with the National Endowment for the Arts, helping soldiers write their stories, most of the stories I got were like the experience of a woman in basic training, you know, and the strangenesses that she encountered. I mean, the military life affords many opportunities for both, you know, bad things and also good things and funny things and, you know, lots of black humor, and, you know, the military folks are famous for that. So I expect to be fully entertained.
How did you end up being such an expert, though, on the military? Because I remember interviewing you. You were in Philadelphia Inquirer. This was, you know, almost 25 years ago.
Yeah.
And covering very different stuff.
Well, I'm not an expert on the military. You know,
But you're certainly interested in the military.
Of course, yeah. And it's been a huge part of modern life for the last 10 years, much more so than, you know, the previous years of my life. The only thing that I'm even remotely expert in, Marty, are the things that I've researched and written books about or articles about. And if you have success, as I did with Black Hawk Down, it leads to opportunities that I maybe would not have had, or stories that are brought to my attention that I might not have ever heard anything about. So, yes, I've written more about war in the last 10 years, you know, than any point prior. But, you know, for both those reasons, because of the success of Black Hawk Down, but also because I think war has become a huge part of the American experience, for better or for worse.
Well, we've been at war for 10 years now.
There you go.
I just clipped this. This has to do with Somalia and Mogadishu and extremist attacks, 70 dead in the Somalian capital. This, of course, goes back to Black Hawk Down and the book that you wrote that became a movie, but also just this is a country that's still barely a country.
Right.
Do you think about Somalia?
I think about it all the time. And my prediction at the end of Black Hawk Down has unfortunately borne out, which is that things are not going to be resolved there at any time in the near future. And the goodwill of the world has sailed away. The UN, you know, made this enormous effort in the early 1990s, and it ended badly. And it will stand for all times as a sort of a cautionary note toward, you know, this impulse to help people who are starving around the world. You know, no one is rushing to Somalia's aid, which is terribly, terribly tragic, because hundreds of thousands of people are going to die. But when I was there, you know, I'd always hear the Somalis would say, well, when the UN comes back, you know, we're going to do this or do that. And I'd say, well, you know what? I just don't think it's coming back. And so far, that appears to be the case.
And have you gone back to Somalia?
I have not. The day I left Somalia was one of the happier days of my life. And I've been invited to go for one thing or another, but unless I have a really good reason, I don't intend to visit.
Because it's so dangerous and so volatile?
Yeah, very dangerous, very volatile. And, you know, if I had a job to do there, if I had a story to tell, I would try to do as much as I could safely, but I haven't written about it since. I'm often called and asked to comment on about events in Somalia, and I tell people, you know, I haven't been there since 1997. I haven't kept up on what's going on. You could find people who are in a better position than I am.
Well, we interviewed you about the hikers, the American hikers that were detained by the Iranian government, held in prison. That's because you wrote a book, Guests of the Ayatollah.
Mm-hmm.
They have been released,
right,
as we know. Did you think that that was going to be the final ending of this very?
I did. I thought
saga?
That they would eventually release them. I think it's just reprehensible that the Iranian government still is taking hostages. I thought it was funny one morning, Ann Curry was on the Today Show, and she made a slip. She was both trying to refer to these two young men as hikers, and she said hostages. And in fact, they were hostages. They were being held hostage for political reasons to try to get leverage over the United States for one thing or the other. To me, it's just an illustration of how ruthless this Iranian regime is. I think, you know, my fondest hope is that the Iranian people do something about it in the near future.
Mm. Well, on that note, always a pleasure, Mark Bowden. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times.
My pleasure, Maureen. Thanks.
And you're very welcome. And he's a contributing editor for Vanity Fair, also a national correspondent for The Atlantic, the author of a number of books. The most recent one is titled Worm, the First Digital World War. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times, and you can find out much more about this program, including Facebook and Twitter, email, the archives, and you can also see what our guests look like. Because Mark Bowden is on our Facebook page. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscowen. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.